we're coming into an era where admission of mistakes and learning from them is becoming passé. How many people put on social media they screwed up? Everything's perfect. Nobody's failing anything. Nobody has any problems. It's all a big secret. Everyone's smiling. When does anybody put a picture up of crying? We live in a world of massaging the perceptions out there. And so I have to learn from these things. They say making a mistake is human. Repeating it makes you stupid. And I agree with that. It's okay to make a mistake, but the second time, you have to learn from these things.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast.
I'm Raman Sehgal, recovering marketer.
And I'm Rajiv Sathyal, the funny Indian. Raman and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know, but want to know more about.
It's kind of like bringing a microphone to a cup of coffee.
On today's show, we decided to have another conversation with James Michael Lafferty, currently the CEO of Fine Hygienic Holding, the market leader in consumer tissue for the Middle East and North Africa. Hopefully you caught his first appearance, hosted by fellow P&G alumni host Andrew Tarvin, who held an amazing conversation with James. If not, I highly recommend it. You can find the link in the show notes. Many of you know this, but many of you may not. Jim started in the P&G Fitness Center and ended up as a vice president in brand management. That's right, folks, from the gym to senior management. And I'm desperately going to try to avoid making a Jim pun here. Anyway, honestly, I was a bit jealous of Andrew. Years ago, I shared a stage with Jim at GE as I did stand-up comedy. He gave a speech about his strategies for winning in both your personal and professional lives. In fact, I still quote from that speech. And though Andrew extracted such great nuggets from Jim, I knew there was more in the well. What I did not know is where this chat would lead. When we asked Jim which topic he'd like to address, he chose the biggest mistakes I've made in my career and life. Perhaps the last word should have provided some foreshadowing, but I hadn't yet picked up on it. In my 4+ decades on Earth, I've never heard a business leader make himself more vulnerable. I truly feel this type of dialogue has the potential to be a game changer if we can all become as open and honest as our guest today, James Michael Lafferty. Welcome, James Lafferty, back to the P&G Alumni Podcast. It is a thrill to have you return. Your episode was so popular that we decided to bring you back on for a specific topic. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, and thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I've listened to your episode several times, at least three. I think that's several, and maybe even more than that. And I always gain some additional pearls of wisdom. You graciously decided to come back after we asked you to say, hey, look, is there something specifically you would like to discuss? And you picked the idea of the mistakes that you've made and what you've learned from them. Is that correct? I want to make sure I have the subject right before we proceed.
Yeah, I think so, because so often, especially as people see more success, they don't acknowledge their mistakes. I mean, everything is projected. If you look at social media today and Facebook, everybody's got a perfect life. Mm-hmm. And you know, we don't come out often and acknowledge the mistakes, and hence we don't often learn from them. So I've always been focused also on, you know, where did I make the mistakes in life? Where did I turn right instead of turning left? And that helps you learn and grow and dealing with things. And also, even as a leader, it builds transparency. I mean, when leaders stand up and say, I made a mistake, people admire that. When leaders refuse to say that, and they're hung up on what they believe their public perception is or the perception of their persona and their organization, that's when the trouble begins. And so I've even found that being transparent and honest and acknowledging mistakes with an organization is one of the elements that builds authenticity and trust.
Paul has found that security comes from confidence and insecurity comes from arrogance. Is that why leaders, maybe, you know, leaders are people, are they loath to admit that because they have some kind of insecurity?
I think so. I think I've always believed that showing your emotions is a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness. I mean, we train people, you shouldn't cry. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't show any emotion. And these people don't come across as authentic. The organization doesn't believe them. And so through a series of misperceptions, you know, we craft leaders into people that really don't come across as effective leaders. They refuse to show emotion, and they certainly refuse to show what they think is weakness. That's what kills many leaders in the face of their organizations is they don't deal with things transparently and honestly. They believe that they have to be infallible. They have to be like superhuman. Mm-hmm. And that's not what people want to work for. People want to work for real, authentic humans, people that have emotions, people that have ups and downs, people that acknowledge. That's why you see in the world today when a Naomi Osaka, for example, comes out and says, you know, I'm struggling with some mental health issues and I'm not going to play in the French Open or mm-hmm. Wimbledon. The predominance of comments from people is you're so brave.
Mm-hmm.
The old system was you can't admit anything.
Right.
And you look at the reactions to these situations like the Naomi Osaka situation, it's overwhelmingly positive. Because this is what people have always wanted. They want real, authentic leaders, people that feel emotions, people that show emotions, people that make mistakes and at least acknowledge them and move on. I mean, mistakes are okay. They're just fine.
Yeah. Has that changed? I mean, it has, obviously, to your point. I mean, obviously, this opening up is fairly recent. Do you think people always longed for that? Or is there something that has changed either in American culture or the global monoculture that has driven that?
I think they've always perceived it. And if you look at in the political arena, let's take Cincinnati and former mayor Jerry Springer. I mean, many people don't know Springer's story. You know, they think he's running this talk show and having these people coming in throwing things at each other and screaming and these overly dramatic talk shows. But he was the mayor of the city. And if you go back and look, I think it was in 78, he purchased a prostitute.
Right.
He was caught. The check he wrote the prostitute bounced. And she went to the press in 78. I think it was 78. I might be wrong on the date, but let's assume it's 1978. She went to the press.
Sure.
And they called him out on it. And he marched up on stage with his wife. And he stood there and he said, I have embarrassed myself. Mm. I've embarrassed my family. And I've embarrassed the office of the mayor of the city of Cincinnati. I resign. And he walked off stage. 2 years later, he was reelected. And people loved the transparency. And later on, when Hugh Grant was caught in L.A. with the prostitute, he even quoted it. He said it's called the Springer effect. Mm-hmm. He said, if you go public and you acknowledge everything, it's over quickly. And he went on every talk show. Mm-hmm. And Jay Leno asked him, what were you thinking? And he said, I wasn't thinking. And within a week, the whole thing was gone. And today, no one talks about it. No one ever talks about Hugh Grant in that incident. But see, you take people like Clinton. Mm-hmm. You know, President Clinton, he fought it brutally. He played lawyer games. Mm-hmm. You know, he came across and said things like, what's the definition of sex? You know, what does that really mean? You know,
it depends what is.
Right. And all the arguing about two letter words. Mm-hmm. And that dogs him to this day. Mm-hmm. To this day, he never got, because, you know, I think the smart PR people in these situations say, look, just come clean and remove all doubt. And you know, when I was a young guy in Cincinnati and at the University of Cincinnati, my girlfriend got pregnant in 1984. Mm. We were both college students. Now, 1984 was a different time.
Mm-hmm.
This was an incredibly traumatic thing for everybody and the families and all this. And at the time, I was on the board. I was the youngest board member in the history of the YMCA of Cincinnati and Hamilton County. So here I'm on the Young Men's Christian Association board. And I went in and I said, my girlfriend is pregnant and I take full responsibility for this. And I resigned from this board because I don't think I should be sitting on the board.
Mm.
And the chairman stood up, who was this very devout, religiously devout individual. And he said, you know, I admired you so much the whole time I've known you, but I admire you more now than ever. And he said, I refuse to accept your resignation. Mm. And the whole board voted, we don't accept your resignation. We want you to stay. So here was this stigma and this whole drama of the pregnancy. And I got someone pregnant and I'm 20 years old and all this stuff. and they were fine. And so then I was coaching at Forest Park Middle School in the Winton Woods School District in the north part of Cincinnati.
I know it well. I grew up in Fairfield.
Yeah, so you were right next door. So I'm at Forest Park Middle School. The athletic director of Forest Park at that time was a guy named Charlie Frederick, who was a former great athlete at Notre Dame and just a wonderful man. And I said to myself, I shouldn't be coaching 13 and 14-year-old kids with this situation. So I drive to his office at Forest Park High School, and I go in, and he's like, Jim, you know, and pat me on the back. And I said, look, I need to tell you something. You know, Susan, my girlfriend's pregnant, and I don't think I should be teaching young people in this situation. And he looks at me, he says, that's baloney. He said, you know, this is so admirable. He said, I want you to stay, and I want you to use this situation as a teaching tool to your, you know, your own athletes. And so I went around admitting everything, not doing the hiding stuff, or let's send the girlfriend off to another state and have her deliver the baby in private. You know, what other people did, like you disappear for 8 months. I was completely public, and everyone embraced me. So I went around to resign from these jobs because I was working in either the YMCA or I was coaching young people, and no one took the resignation. And this was in 1984. And I think people have always done it. And you know, by being honest and transparent, you got more respect, like Springer did, than you did if you tried to play all of the finesse games and talk yourself out. We're all human. We all make mistakes.
What's amazing about those examples, well, first of all, when Hugh Grant went on Jay Leno's show, it was the first time that Jay Leno overtook David Letterman in the rankings. People were so pent up and so excited to hear this, and what is he going to say? And Leno never looked back. And I think that underlines, writ large, your point about people wanted that authenticity. They wanted that realness. They wanted to know what actually happened. And it was a funny interview, and I've watched it historically a couple of times, but that is how significant it is, and it seems to underline your point. You know, with Jerry Springer, whom I saw actually, I ate next to him at an Italian restaurant in Beverly Hills. I didn't bother him. It was my uncle and I, and we were sitting right next to him. And I thought, you know what? He gets harassed so much. I don't really need to say anything to him. But what I do remember from Jerry Springer, I was born in 76, and I think 78 was the blizzard too. The blizzard of 78 is what people talk about in Cincinnati.
Yep.
You know, I watched Jerry Springer give those commentaries on NBC News, and it was just so interesting, the local channel, and he was so insightful. He was so interesting. And when I found out that that's what he had done, I was stunned. And it's funny you say that. He was a very respected man in Cincinnati, and then his show, you know, became the Jerry Springer show. And ironically, or maybe coincidentally, that's what politics became as well. So your point about Bill Clinton, and it continues to this day where it doesn't seem like any of these politicians want to own anything. It's just fight it, fight it, fight it to the bitter end. And I hate to say that model seems to be working. It offends me. But what do you have to say about that? That it doesn't seem to be going in that direction? Or do you think business is different and people's personal lives are different? Or do you think we're emulating that?
I think it's working for some people, and it's working for some core constituencies and core groups of voters. But overall, it doesn't work. And you know, I'm sad at how I see things. You know, I give it as an example to people. I say, look, when I was the CEO of P&G Poland, the ambassador, Christopher Hill, who's very high in the State Department, and he negotiated like the Bosnian Accords for the Bosnia War and all of that. We were close friends, and he called me and he said, look, I've got a congressional delegation coming in. And, you know, would you take them around? Would you host them? I said, of course. It's my responsibility. He said, you're kind of the ranking American CEO in an American company. Will you do it? And I said, sure. So I take this delegation around. You know, we don't need to get into names, but some of these people are completely out of Congress today and disgrace. They were awful. Wow. As a general rule, they were just awful. They were high maintenance, and they were very, very, the whole attitude was, you are in this world to serve me. I'm not a servant to the taxpayer. I mean, there was nothing. And we had a meeting in P&G, and one of them threw this fit because I had local Polish bottled water and I didn't have like international brands like Evian. Yeah, so I had to like send people out to buy water because this guy is so stressed out and high maintenance and being a child. Like, I don't want to drink water I don't know. I mean, what do you think? Yeah. This is Poland. This is a great country. They know what they're doing. They can bottle water. I've been drinking it and I'm just fine. So, but that was the attitude. And so I fast forward to last year. Here I am living in the United Arab Emirates, which is, it's free, but the government, the Sheikh and his family run the government. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to worry about, and it's interesting when you see when people are benevolent, but they don't have to worry about voters.
Right.
So during the pandemic, there was some fundraising going on for kids in the area in Dubai who couldn't afford school. And in my company, Fine Hygienic Holding, we paid to send like 100 kids to school and stuff. So he had this award ceremony and he calls me to come to it. And, I come to it. They give us awards. And at the end of it, he and I are just chatting. And here's the first question he says to me. Now, this is the ruler of Dubai. Hmm. He's a billionaire. He doesn't have to worry about losing his job. Mm-hmm. What does he say to me? He says, are you happy in my city?
Wow.
So that was the first question. He just wanted to know if I was happy. And so my response was, honestly, Your Highness, how you handled COVID and Dubai handled COVID like nobody else. I mean, we were out of this thing so quick because everybody got vaccinated. It was all done through the Department of Health. They sent a message on your phone. There was an app. You go 5 minutes later, you're vaccinated. It was easy. They had enough doses for everybody. We were at 95% vaccination, within months.
Wow.
Of the vaccines coming out. And Dubai's been wide open for a long time and nobody gets sick and, we're all fine. And there was also none of this baloney, like there's radio transmitters and all this nutsy stuff. I mean, we all got vaccinated and everybody's fine. And so I told him, you have done an amazing job. Mm-hmm. And he says to me, and I said, I feel very blessed that I was in Dubai during this pandemic because I came from Manila and the Philippines is still in a mess with the pandemic. They still haven't gotten it completely under control. There's new variants all the time and many people are sick and they don't even know how many people have died.
Wow.
And so I told him I felt blessed. And he says to me, he says, that's all I want to know. Is that you're happy here. And he gives me his card and he says, if you find things that make you unhappy, just let me know and we'll fix it.
Wow.
And if you look at the government of Dubai, they have all these ministers. There's a minister of finance and a minister of investment and a minister of health. They have a minister of happiness.
I've heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. They have a minister of happiness. And I sit on the advisory board of the Ministry of Happiness. And what we do all day is sit and decide projects that will make people happier here. So if there's traffic in a specific area, they figure out how to reduce the traffic. You have a city. When I open the newspaper or if I go to the Inquirer and there's a garbage strike and the crime is up X percent. There was a shooting and over the Rhine and there's all this stuff. This is a city that's not grappling with this stuff. It's grappling with how do we make it better? How do we make people happier? How do we make this a really idyllic place to live? And it's a whole different mindset. It's a whole different game in that you don't see most U.S. cities having that kind of a mindset. And so you look around the world today, these cities like Dubai and Singapore are the future cities. And they're amazing places to live. They're just amazing places to live.
Wow. What is the population of Dubai? How many people live there?
Well, the total UAE, I think Dubai is about 4.5 to 5 million people in total.
Oh, okay. That's not small. I mean, when you think of it, I've been there and I performed there actually. But yeah, I didn't have a concept of how many people. So, it's one thing if the city is, and I know it's bigger than this, if it's 100,000 people, you go, yeah, it's easy for them. But 4.5 to 5 million people, that's a significant number in the fact that they've been able to pull that off. To what do you attribute that? Is that, obviously they have a Ministry of Happiness and you just walked me through that, but is that cultural? Is that because it's the Middle East? Is it because specifically this ruler, it's international? Well, what's driving that? Like how have they been able to do this?
Well, the ruler of Dubai and his father are quite wise. I'll tell you a great story that they say that they were interviewing his father, who was like the founder of the UAE and the founder of Dubai. And they said, What kind of car do you drive? And he said, I drive a Mercedes. Mm-hmm. And he said, what kind of car do you think your great-grandchildren are going to drive? And he said, let me tell you how it evolves. He said, my grandfather didn't drive anything. He rode a camel. And he said, my father didn't drive anything. He rode a camel. He said, we built Dubai up. He said, I drive a Mercedes. He said, my son will drive a Range Rover. My grandson will drive a Range Rover. And he said, my great-grandson will drive a camel. And the interviewer said, what? He said, look, you have to understand something. Great men are born from tough times. And life in Dubai and in the UAE, this is all desert. This whole thing was just a bunch of sand. This was tough. Life was tough here. It's hot. I mean, when I hear people in the U.S. complaining about 90 degrees, 90 degrees is like we wear sweaters here in 90 degrees because most days it's 110, 115, 120. That's the temperature here. So it's hot and it's dry and it was sand.
But you still need your sweater because the malls are freezing cold. And so you go in there and it's 65 degrees. You're like, oh, I should have brought a jacket.
You're right. Absolutely. So tough times create great men. And then great men create good times and good times create weak men. And so his point was by three generations, people will be weak because the city has been built up to be so tremendous. But we're still in the middle of the buildup because the people that are here remember how tough it was. But give it another generation or two and people won't remember and they will grow up a bit soft. And you know, this dynamic has come out in many ways. There was the organization YPO, which I'm a member of, but it was really built for family businesses to get the kind of training and development that people in large corporations like P&G get. So YPO is a global organization. They did a global study on family businesses and that they had an amazing statistic. Only 16% of family businesses make it through the third generation. And when they dug into why, they say, well, the founder sacrificed and built it up. The children of the founder watched the sacrifices and the build up. But the grandchildren grew up with a silver spoon in their mouth. And the grandchildren destroyed the business that grandpa built because they never went through the sacrifices. And you know, all of this, and I look at some of my own kids. I've got six kids ranging from 37 to 6 months old. You know, I've got quite a big gap of kids there. I made a mistake with some of them, and I admit it, and I've admitted to them, which was I grew up in a very tough situation. I had tough times in my life, and certainly in Cincinnati and growing up in lower middle class and then, you know, paying for school by myself and then the pregnancy. You know, I had tough times. That forged me. And then I put so much effort into making sure my kids didn't go through what I went through that I deprived them of the very struggle that helps make people. And so it was done out of love and it was done with all the right intentions, but I made mistakes and I made things too easy. I made things too simple when a struggle is important. I mean, the power of perseverance is, it's immeasurable what it does for people to teach people to persevere and to go through adversity. Adversity forges steel. And when you deprive your children of adversity, you don't really equip them to go out and compete head on in this world.
I mean, I think you're seeing that with, you know, generation XYZ, et cetera, and people being soft and safe spaces and all the things that we see, you know, as the children or as the child of immigrants. I heard a while ago that the first generation saves, the second generation spends, and the third generation wastes.
Yeah, that's about what the YPO study shows.
Yeah, right. 16%. I'm writing that down, and I was just amazed to know. And when I heard that, Gamble, you know, you think about how many changes they've gone through since 1837, and they're still there. I mean, to what do you attribute that sort of thing? And P&G is not the only one, but it's certainly a shining example of that. You know, how is that possible that Procter & Gamble was able to persevere for so long?
Well, P&G has done a tremendous job. I mean, people can learn how to win. They can learn how to lose. They can learn how to stick it out. They can learn how to quit. P&G did just a tremendous job from the very beginning in building a culture and setting standards of excellence and being quite self-deprecating, you know, dealing with issues. I mean, the story of how the guy in the factory on Ivory Soap left the pump running and pumped more air into it and it started floating by accident. And how the company handled that and how they dealt with those types of things. I mean, the culture became very, very deep. And it basically passed generation to generation. Now, there's always these people, and I've refused to be one of them, where they'll say, it's not the company it used to be, and it's not, you know, they kind of badmouth it in a sense. But the company keeps cranking out the results. And I think the culture is alive and well. And people like David Taylor, you know, who's now stepped down as CEO, David was the epitome of a P&G leader. You know, I worked with him. I replaced him in Western Europe. And then we were peers. And then he was my boss. I mean, David was the best of the best. And you know, that they made great choices on leaders, and they perpetuated generation from generation. And I see, as I've gone and worked in other companies, that no one had that kind of commitment to excellence and that ability to be self-deprecating like P&G was. P&G admits its mistakes. Mm-hmm. You know, go back to Rely Tampon. They go back to it. P&G will come out and say, we made a mistake. Mm-hmm. P&G deals with things in a transparent and honest way, and that allows them to learn and grow and grow from their own mistakes. And they've kept that alive, and I give them a lot of credit. Very proud to have been a small part of the line that passes from generation to generation in that company.
So when you think about mistakes that you've made, and you had said, hey, it's in business and in life, can you walk me through, you know, well, let me start with this. And we've sort of touched on it, but I guess I want to ask it more explicitly. Why this topic? Why did you submit this one and say, hey, this is what I want to talk about? Why do you believe it's so important?
Because I think we're coming into an era in how society goes through peaks and troughs and different periods where admission of mistakes and learning from them is becoming passé in many respects. And it's becoming how many people put on social media that they screwed up? Everything's perfect. I know people that put pictures that here's me and my beloved spouse, and then 3 months later they announce they're getting divorced.
Right.
So all the pictures was just BS.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody's family. I mean, if you look at Facebook, I'm not a big fan of Facebook. If you look at Facebook, everybody's got the perfect life.
Right.
All their kids are perfect. Now, nobody's failing anything.
Yeah.
No one's got any kind of alcohol or addiction. Nobody has any problems. It's all a big secret. It's all, everyone's smiling. When does anybody put a picture up of crying?
Right.
When does anybody put a picture up of distress? And so, you know, we live in a fake world, and we live in a world of massaging the perceptions out there. And so when you're in that type of situation, you don't deal with the mistakes. And I always try to come back and learn from my mistakes. I also do things. Bracken Darrell, who's leading Logitech XP&G and just a super guy, he has this great drill that he does every year in Logitech. He writes a termination letter to himself. And he fires himself for the last year. And he finds the mistakes that he made. And he reads the letter and he's like, I have to learn from this. I fired myself. And I thought it was the most amazing exercise. So I go in the office and I write this letter and I fire myself and I see all the mistakes that I made. And you say, okay, now we still grew or we still had a good year, but I made so many mistakes and I have to learn from these things. Wow. As they say, making a mistake is human. Repeating it makes you stupid. And I agree with that. It's okay to make a mistake, but the second time, you have to learn from these things.
That's what they say about skydiving. You don't need a parachute to go skydiving. You need a parachute to go skydiving twice.
Ah, that's very true. Very true, my friend.
Yeah, very fair. So that's really fascinating. So he'll fire himself. And does he read that letter to his board or to his employees or to anyone? Or is it just a personal exercise that he engages in just to do some self-reflection?
I'm not sure. I got the feeling it was maybe shared with his management team, maybe shared with the board. I didn't get the feeling he sent it to every employee in every part of the company. But I felt like, I mean, but he does come out and say he does it. I mean, everyone knows he does it. Now, the contents of the letter, the feeling I got was he uses it a lot with himself. He uses it to keep himself humble. I mean, he's getting quite a bit of praise in the world as being one of the great CEOs of a publicly traded company. The stock price and the performance. I mean, he's being told he's great. And he says, I use it for humility and to show how many mistakes I've made. He uses it with his leadership team to keep him grounded, his management board, and I think with his board of directors. And it's such an effective, authentic fabulous concept of someone who wants to get better every day. And I think Bracken is better today than he was yesterday, and tomorrow he'll be better than he is today. And this is the essence of making it is continual improvement.
Hmm. So could you walk me through maybe an early one, maybe from your childhood, a mistake you made, or it doesn't have to be your childhood, it could be adolescence or even later, but starting maybe a little bit more towards the beginning, since you're talking about mistakes you've made in life and in business. Obviously, I you know, it's, you shared a very, very personal one here with the pregnancy at such a young age. I don't want to call that a mistake, but certainly something that maybe wasn't planned, at least. Can you walk me through one or something like that, and maybe what you learned?
Yeah, I mean, we can go that there's, you know, I have very clear recollections of the key mistakes in my life. And then the other ones, I mean, they kind of drift away, but what are the ones that were really defining? The first one was, I think we were like 12, 10, 11, 12. And the big thing in our neighborhood was collecting matchbooks, you know, from different hotels and stuff. And it was this, you know, this was the thing. And we would show them and compare them and all that. And I had all these different from Holiday Inns and places my parents would stay on vacation. And this friend across the street, you know, who's my best friend, he had the coolest things from these like different Oriental restaurants and stuff, the amazing matchbooks and boxes of matches. And we were at his house looking, and I was just so jealous. And so he gets up to go to the toilet. And when he's in the toilet, I steal like three or four of his packs of matches. And I put them in my pocket and I go home. And I'm at home, and like an hour later, the phone rings, and he asks my mom if I'm there, and she hands me the phone. He says, "You stole my packs." And I tried to put on a game face, like I didn't steal them, but I'm not really a very good poker player. And within like a minute, I said, "I'm really sorry, and I'll bring them over." And I came over, I took my best matchbooks, and I went over his house, and I gave him his back, and I gave him all of mine, my good ones. And I was crying and crying because I had stolen from like my best friend.
Yeah,
that, you know, he was different to me. Now we're still good friends to this day, and we grew up together, and we were at each other's weddings and the wedding stuff.
Wow.
We've stayed very close, and, you know, he just turned 60 and I turned 59, and, you know, we've been, you know, friends for literally 55 years.
Wow.
But I stole from my best friend, a guy who never did anything to me, and the guilt was so enormous that was the last time I ever stole anything in my life. In high school, the dare to go into a store and steal candy with my friends, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
I just wouldn't do it. And I never stole anything again. And so I basically said, I felt so bad and so rotten that there would never be another theft. And I never took anything again. You know, not a penny from anybody. And I actually celebrated like being honest. But you had to go through the shame of stealing from a friend before I could learn. Obviously, I went to Catholic schools. I learned the 10th commandments and thou shalt not steal. I get it. But it never really hit home until I stole from my friend and he called me out on it and I admitted it. And then the shame of what I did impacting me.
What a great story. And it is better that way than had you been busted, you know, stealing something from a store. And, you know, that's, they could scare you with the security guard or the cop or whatever. And that's more, you know, what do they call that? Attrition or you know, that sort of forgiveness, which isn't real. But this is more of a touching direct, like you saw the effect of what theft can do. And that certainly resonates with me. I pride myself on the fact that I've never stolen anything either. So that I may have cheated on a couple of things, may have lied a few times. I'm sure we've all lied at some point and maybe have cheated on something, not on a person, but on something. But I remember stolen, and I always felt like stealing was, I don't know, it felt so wrong. And I had been stolen from too. And I was like, that's just not a great feeling.
Yeah, but it's amazing how people can justify. You know, I've caught in different jobs at Coke Nigeria where we were polygraph testing people and we would catch thieves all the time. I mean, it's quite interesting how people can justify theft. I mean, I've caught hundreds of thieves and put them in jail in my corporate life, including in P&G. And they'll come and say, look, I deserve the money anyway because you didn't promote me. I mean, there's always a basis. I've never had a single thief.
Wow.
And I'm talking about hundreds that I've interviewed face to face when we were arresting them. I mean, even now, I've got a guy in Jordan I just put in jail, a salesman who stole. And, you know, we locked them up. You know, I don't mess around. They'll say, they don't come out and say, I'm just a thief. No one ever says that.
Right.
They say, I was deprived
right.
of a promotion or a raise that I deserved, and I'm just getting what's mine.
They owe me this.
There's a complete justification. And so, you know, I understand. That's why, you know, things get tough, like kickbacks. I tell people all the time, a principal is not a principal till it costs you something.
I love that.
So everyone will, if you ask them, would you take a bribe? They say no. I don't care what you say now. I only care what you say when someone's offering you a bribe.
Yeah.
So in my time in P&G, I had multiple, even in Cincinnati, I had a film company once offer me like $10,000 kickback to give them the business. That was a piece of cake to say no. It's like 1 second. It's like, are you joking?
Right.
Forget it. But then in Nigeria, I get a $7 million offer. $7 million to award the sugar contract to a company.
Wow.
Because I'm buying $200 million in sugar. I was the biggest sugar buyer in the continent. And so, you know, you're talking about big, big money we were buying in sugar. And they put $7 million on the table. And I tell this to kids all the time. I say, I admit it. I didn't say no for a day because I thought about it for a day. And I laid in bed and I said, how, you know, and they were, it was all going to be set up. They'll put it in some numbered account, Swiss account, and it'll be fine. Nobody will ever know, blah, 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 blah. When I went back and said no, it hurt like hell.
Yeah.
It was no, but it was like, because a principal is not principal till it costs you something.
Yeah.
If I say yes, the cost is I'm a thief now and I'm dishonest. If I say no, I don't get the $7 million.
Yeah.
And all the things I can spend it on and the extra house I can buy.
Are you a fool?
Alps,
yeah.
That's a lot of money. All this stuff. And so, you know, you go through this whole dilemma and you say, now we're going to find out what your principles are. And if your principle is honesty, which is the right thing to do and which I would always encourage people to do, it will still be painful because you will walk away from something that you know would have had benefit for you, like a kickback of that size. The key is when people say to me, that guy doesn't have principles, I always disagree. Everybody is principled. The question is not whether they're principled or not. The question is, what are their principles?
Yeah. They always say that, you know, show me a man's budget and I'll tell you what his principles are.
Yeah.
And $7 million is, you know, anything over $3-4 million is not just life-changing, but also generation-changing. And people justify that by a couple different ways. They go, well, I'm just taking care of my family. I mean, that's what they said in the movie The Insider. And I remember hearing that. I go, gosh, what a justification. What a terrible justification for things. But some people don't feel that way. They're like, no, you got to get yours for your family. And that's what you're supposed to do. And other people say, hey, look, Jim, hey, James, if you don't take this, you know, the next guy is just going to take it. And you're just prolonging the inevitable. But then for a boy who did not steal out of the candy jar, to put your hand in that big of a sugar jar feels like the ultimate irony. So good for you. That would be hard. And I think the fact that it took you some time makes you human. I think if you would have just said, nope, I just walked away, I'd be like, that's interesting. Really? I don't know if I even believe that story, because I think everybody would take a beat just to go, should I do this or not? But wow, that's a lot of money. That's a big sum. So, So obviously that's not a mistake you made. That's something that you, it was a potential mistake, but that was something where you took the right path and you were happy about.
Yeah. I mean, look, the biggest mistake of my life is I'm public about it. It's so big that number two and number three, I don't even know what they are.
Wow.
And it goes, so the girlfriend that got pregnant, we got married. Now, we got married after the baby was a year and a half old. And maybe we weren't perfectly fit, but we made the thing work. And we had a good marriage. We had tough times, so we made the thing work. She went around the world with me with P&G, and you know, we ended up having five kids, and including an adopted one. Now, you know, when P&G, I'm also transparent. I was pushed out of the company. I'm not mad. You know, I was pushed out. I had a very bad year in the Philippines. I was the CEO. I have to pay the price.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And they, you know, they pushed me out. Now, you know, a lot of people that are band six like me, they'll give this sob story of I decided to spend more time with my family and everybody collapsed. It's all BS.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give the whole of, you know, family thing. I admit it. And now P&G was classy and it was dignified. And they called me and said, look, maybe it's time we part ways and you can retire and you'll get all your stock. You know, P&G is a class act, and I played it classy, and I did training. I went around the world. I stayed for another year.
Wow.
But they pushed me out, and it was the middle of the global financial crisis. Now, there wasn't a ton of jobs, and we were adopting this Filipino orphan, and the adoption wasn't done. So I had to stay with residency in the Philippines, but I had to find a job because, you know, everything, the timing was just crap.
Yeah.
Because it's a global financial crisis. Nobody's hiring. All the headhunters say, you know, we just don't have anything. And then on top of that, I got four kids in university at the same time.
Wow.
And so my school bill was like $160,000 a year just to pay tuition.
Jeez.
And so I'm in a state of panic. And the only great job, I mean, I got lots of different offers, but the only great job I got was to be the CEO of Coca-Cola in Nigeria, which is 18-hour flight from Manila. Now, my wife had to stay in Manila because we're adopting that baby. We had to keep residency.
Right.
Or we gonna lose the baby. And so this was just so stressful. And so I moved to Nigeria. Now, when I got on that plane, I cried my eyes so hard that on the way to Dubai, the pilot wanted to divert the plane to Malaysia to land because I was crying so much. Because I missed my family. I missed the thing. But then you land in Nigeria and, you know, I've got to dry my eyes and get on with life. I can't just like walk around sobbing all the time. So I dry my eyes and there's a guy waiting for me in a Coca-Cola hat. And they take me to an apartment and I change into a suit and I go to the office for day one of Coca-Cola. And this life was just horrendous. My family is far away. I'm going to see them twice a year because it's not like flying Cincinnati to New York. This is 18 hours in the air to go back and forth.
Yeah.
And so you don't do it very often. And there's nothing to do. I like Lagos. It's got an amazing buzz, but it's not a city like a Dubai. There's not much to do. There's like one little shopping mall. There's nothing. You know, you basically kind of stay. I would come home and I had a cook and he would make me sandwiches.
No.
And so I started running every morning. I'm running every morning and if I saw someone running, which wasn't very often, I would pull over and grab them and I would take a pen out and write on my arm, what's your email?
Yeah.
And over the first 6 months, I built up like a mailing list of like 100 people.
Wow.
And I built the biggest running club in West Africa. And because I was selling a brand in Coke called Ebba Water, and the water brand is like the sport that the water brands in Coke sponsor is running. It was the Ebba Water Running Club, and I put this team together. And there was a woman running with us who had a lot of talent. You know, she wanted to learn how to run, and she was really a natural Nigerian woman. And I trained and coached her and got her to the 2012 London Olympics. And so, you know, within a year and a half, we had her on the Olympic team. And she had never run, you know, races before, and she was started running at like 31 years old. And here we were going to take her to the Olympics. Now, we kind of fell for each other.
Okay.
And, you know, I didn't want this to happen. I didn't mean for it to happen. It wasn't some fling. It was a serious set of feelings. And we started a very torrid, serious romance.
Wow.
And I cheated on my wife. And my wife confronted me and I told her the truth. I said, yeah, I'm having an affair. And it caused a complete destruction of the marriage. And it just spiraled out of control. The distance and everything is spiraled out of control. I eventually left Coke and moved back to Asia to try to save my marriage, but it was too late. Mm-hmm. And infidelity just kills a marriage. Mm-hmm. And she did things to get back at me, but this is all my fault. I never blamed her on anything. She stood by my side and I didn't say true. And I've learned so much because I was married 26 years. For 25 years, I was a great husband and never, ever cheated once anything, not even remotely on anything with anyone on her. But then in year 26, I had an affair. And you know what? It doesn't matter if the first 25 years you don't have an affair. If you cheat in year 26, you're still just a philandering husband. At the end of the day, you don't get like any bonus points. You don't say, for every 10 years of being true to you, I get a hall pass for a week. It doesn't work like that. You don't get any hall pass.
So,
I couldn't use any of my fly miles, to buy my next plane ticket. I was in the doghouse. And we got divorced and, you know, and I made a lot of decisions on this and I'm happy with how I did it, even though it was, you know, very tough on, you know, certainly the financial side. I didn't hire a lawyer. We got divorced in Chicago and Cook County.
Wow.
I didn't hire a lawyer.
Hmm.
And the judge was flabbergasted. And I said, you know, lawyers make these things confrontational. She stood by me. I screwed up. I will give her what she wants because I know she'll be fair. I will give her what she wants. And I'm not hiring a lawyer and we're not going to have any fights.
Wow.
And if I could undo everything that went on in Nigeria, I would undo it. But here's the problem. I can't undo it. So all I can do is the following going forward. I can, one, take care of my ex-wife and take care of our son, who's now 14 years old, and be the perfect father. And there'll never be an argument. And the second thing is if I get remarried, and I did, and my ex-wife got remarried, this will never happen a second time. I mean, if Angelina Jolie comes to my door in a bikini and says, I'm here for you, I slam the door shut.
Yeah.
Because I screwed up once. I fell into a temptation. I had real feelings for this person. It wasn't a fling. Mm-hmm. But I made that mistake once. There won't be a second time. And my wife today is a wonderful, amazing woman. She knows damn well that I will never cheat a second time because I screwed up the first time. I won't do that to this marriage. And my ex-wife and I are best friends.
Wow.
We talk every single day.
Wow.
We share on everything. We support each other in everything. And we're best friends. And she's happy in her marriage. I'm happy for her. And he's a good man. And she's happy for me. And I'm remarried. We both found our peace, but we'll always be close. We had 5 kids together. And she knows that I've admitted it. I don't blame her. I didn't make up stories.
Mm-hmm.
All I ask people is that you weren't in my shoes. You weren't living far away. And you were only seeing your wife twice a year.
Yeah.
Now, that's not an excuse,
sure.
But it's at least a mitigating circumstance. Now,
sure.
I'm still at the end. I was weak and I'm still stupid and I get it. And I was an asshole. I completely admit all of this. But, you know, it goes on. And what was interesting is you find out who your friends are.
Yeah.
I mean, I had some people I thought were my friends. They're the most judgmental, total a-holes in the history of the planet. Because I have never judged anyone who got divorced or had a marital issue because you don't know what goes on in people's marriages.
So true.
I mean, for me to make a judgment to someone else is ridiculous. All I've ever done when I've had friends get divorced is I tell the both sides, we love you. I'm your friend. I'm here for you. I make no judgment. But my God, did I have people come out of the woodwork, even in my own family, you know, I can't speak to you again. And you say, you know, you pompous
S-O-B.
Person, you know, you have never made a mistake in your life. I admit it, but I can't go and undo this thing. I mean, I can't undo the affair.
Right.
And I wish I could, but I can't. And so all I can do is do it right going forward. And make sure it never happens again. And that's what I'm doing. And that's what I will do. And, you know, how many people in a U.S. divorce, a P&G general manager, don't even hire legal counsel because they don't want any confrontation. They want to remain best friends.
Unheard of.
So I told her, take what you want. Take what you want. No fights, no hiding money, no playing games, no trusts, no BS. Here, take it, and I made her very wealthy. But you know what? She followed me all around the world with P&G. She earned that money from P&G just like I did. She deserved her peace. And I put up no fight. But what happened is I will not be a victim of the weakness of the flesh a second time. It will not happen. And I will make sure I take care of her and my son, and I do. And we never have had one single fight. And we've been divorced for like 8 years.
Wow.
We haven't even had a single fight because she's so reasonable with me. She'll say, like the other day, she writes me and says, you know, hey, you know, Kenji's got to go. This is our son. Mm-hmm. He's got to go to a soccer camp. It's like $800. She said, are you okay if we split it? I pay $400. You pay $400. I wrote back, said, absolutely. And I'll wire it to you right away. I mean, we don't fight.
Wow.
She's reasonable. She's still, I always love her. She always loved me. We had kids together. She's a great person. She bears no responsibility on this. I take all responsibility for what happened. And we put it in the past and she's forgiven me. And I try to redeem myself and how I can behave going forward. And that's all I can do.
Wow. That's quite a story, James. I had no idea it was going to go in that direction. I super appreciate your vulnerability. You know, I've been married 7 years. It's very new in comparison. And I have to admit, I was one of those judgmental people, you know, and before I was married, and how can people do this and how can people do that? And, you know, one of my crusades well, you're a fitness instructor, you know it. Like, people who just put on so much weight, like, what's wrong with them? Why can't they just lose weight? But I have my temptations. I drink, right? So I had to finally come to the conclusion that, Rajiv, you've got to stop judging people that hard. Like, some people are dealt a bad hand. They have bad glands. They have bad health. They're tempted by food in a way that I'm not. I'm a skinny guy and I love food, but not as much as the next person. I mean, I've seen people gobble their food down. I'm like, wow, I don't love it that much, but I like a drink. I'll probably have a second or a third when you have one. And I said, well, what's the difference then? I mean, you're being really judgmental about something that you don't really understand. And when you get married, gosh, I mean, you know, I think we've been monogamous, and I mean, not my wife and I, but we have been too. But, you know, as a culture and a society, a friend of mine points this out all the time, and he says, human beings may be polyamorous, but are certainly polygamous. I mean, monogamy is very new, and, you know, not to make it about only this side of the gender spectrum, but certainly for a man who is living continents away from his wife, whom he loves, you know, to transgress is completely human. In fact, almost more human than had you not. And it's not really my place to comment on it one way or the other, but it does spark something in me as a fellow married man, someone married a lot fewer years, but just going, I feel you, dog. Like, I understand. Like, I could see how it would be so tempting. And I really appreciate your opening up.
What you're saying about, you know, not judging, it's just so right. And you know, the region I'm in the Middle East. This is ground zero for like LGBTQ. And I'm dying, you know, I'm pushing this as an agenda in our company as part of diversity. And It's shaking a lot of people up because the Arab world is not so open.
Right.
And, you know, I've been in these discussions and I've had multiple people come to me and they say, look, you're pushing too hard on the LGBTQ thing. And they say, look, you know, if we look in the Quran or in the Bible, you know, this is wrong. I say, look, okay, what difference does it make? And I say, we are here to evaluate people on their performance in the company. This is a meritocracy. Their private decisions don't matter. Now, I always tell them the Coca-Cola Nigeria story, which is a great story. And I'll apologize in advance to your readers, your listeners. I have to use one word. It's not a bad word, but okay. You know, it'll be a little bit shocking. So don't worry. You won't have to like beep it out because I'll use the softer word. So we were doing personnel reviews in Nigeria. My boss flew in. He was a very liberal Greek guy. And, you know, he's the president of Coca-Cola Hellenic. And we're sitting there and my sales manager, who's a very religious guy, is doing the reviews of his people and going person by person. And we get to this one guy and he says he's delivering his numbers and he's got good rapport with the customers and he works well with his team. He's developing his talent and everything's going good. And then the guy says, but I have a real problem and I need to raise this. And I was like, oh my God, what's this? And so I'm sitting there and he says, I think this guy has a girlfriend in every one of the towns as part of his territory. And I think he's meeting these girls at night, you know, when he's done with the day. And I think he's having affairs in different cities and he's a married man. And now I'm letting him go on because I'm just not being polite and I'm waiting for him to stop. My boss just is bristling. You know, and he's again, a very liberal Greek executive. Mm-hmm. And he says, can I ask a question? Now, he's the big shot flying in from Athens. So this guy, in good Nigerian fashion, it's a very hierarchical society. They treat, you know, they say, call you chief or oga. You know, they've got different terms. It's a, oh, yes, sir. You know, Mr. Chief, you please share your thoughts. And he looks right at the guy and he says, why do you care what he does with his penis at night? And I started cracking up. I mean, I started laughing uncontrollably. I just started laughing. And he says, why do you care what he does with his penis in his private life? And the guy was flabbergasted. He couldn't get a word out. He said, we don't care what he does with his penis.
Yeah.
We don't care. We care about his performance. And that day hit me so hard. And I've told this to people here in the Middle East. I say, why do you care?
Right.
Look, if they're having an affair and they're cheating on their spouse, I would tell them don't do it. But that has no implication on their evaluation in this company. Mm-hmm. If they are living a life of being a homosexual versus heterosexual, I don't care. Mm-hmm. And I told them, I said, I've had people in the U.S. come. I had a guy in Cincinnati in the late 80s. My ABM comes to me and said, I need to tell you something. I said, what? He said, I'm gay. And I said, I don't care. That was my instant. I said, I don't care. I care what you do here. And you can bring your boyfriend to all the company events.
Wow.
I don't care. That was in 89. And I said, you know, I don't care because it's your life. Now it's maybe not, you know, in BAT, I had the first transgender in the company worldwide. And it's such a great story. I hired this guy in sales. He's average, two rated, you know, normal, just an average guy. Mm-hmm. He comes to me one day and he says, I need to tell you something. I said, what? He said, I want to transform into a woman. I'm really a woman inside.
Wow. Yeah. Transition. Yeah.
And he said, is that okay? And I said, I don't mind. I said, now it's not a decision that I would make for myself.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't go to a doctor and say, get the scalpel out.
Yeah. Right.
You know, let's go to this.
I care what you do with my penis.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to do that. But if you want to do that, that's fine. And I said, you can go for it and I protect you. Mm. And the next day he started the injections of estrogen. Everything started to develop breasts and start wearing women's clothes and start putting makeup on, started use the women's bathroom. Mm. And we were in an office tower in Manila where other companies got upset. So I built a transgender toilet for her.
Wow.
You know, and I built the whole thing and we had one customer. I had a customer write me and say, get this weirdo off my business. I refuse to buy your product until you get her off the business. I wrote the customer back and I said, I support my people. If you don't want to buy, I respect your decision, but I will do nothing with this individual. They're doing a great job. Wow. And we walked away from the business. So,
wow.
I don't worry about it. It's not just because it's a decision I wouldn't make doesn't make it wrong. And that's, I think we're becoming so intolerant. Like, if you don't believe my views, you're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, it's not so black and white. And try to see the other side. You know, I've got a 6-month, I admitted to my wife the other day, I've always been pro-choice. Mm-hmm. Always been pro-choice. Mm-hmm. But I have a 6-month-old.
Right.
And it's been a long time since I've had a baby. It's been 15 years since I've had a baby. I looked at her the other day in all this Roe versus Wade debate.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagined her being vacuum aborted.
Mm. Yeah.
And I started crying. I had tears in my eyes and tears running down my cheeks. And I'm still pro-choice today, Rajiv.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I understand the people who are vehemently pro-life. Mm-hmm. I understand. They're not bad people. That it doesn't. I haven't changed my mind. But, you know, I imagine my own child for a minute being aborted and dying. And that little beautiful little girl that smiles and who warms my heart isn't here on this planet. And a thought chills my blood. So, you know, what I'm trying to do is I'm not trying to be wishy-washy. You know, I'm trying to understand and open a dialogue. And in the PNGGM college, they used to teach, they did a dialogue session. It was just about trying to understand. We have to spend more time to understand. I mean, why do you have to call a liberal, you're a yellow tard and you're a loser and, you know, you're weak and all stuff. And why do we have to call a Trump supporter, you know, like a psycho fanatic? You know, why do we have to get into name calling? Try to understand and step back and understand it. But there's so much vitriol in certainly in the U.S. on the political side. And I'm just trying to understand because I have people that I care about who are pro-life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not. I'm pro-choice. I don't consider them suddenly useless because they've taken a political position that's different from my own. So it's about tolerance and about trying to understand and showing a bit of that. Even if I don't change my mind, I'm trying to understand. And the fact that I did that exercise reduces the ill feelings that you can have for the other side.
You know, that's refreshing to hear because I have a 1-year-old and you know, I the same emotions you've had or similar emotions when I look into his eyes and I think, wow. And I've thought of that during the whole Roe versus Wade. You know, it's a very similar experience. And a friend of mine actually who worked at PNG, she said something very interesting a long time ago, I think when we both still worked there. And she said the problem with the debate, one of the problems with the whole abortion debate is we're arguing two different issues. Choice is not the opposite of life. People who are talking about life are talking about something completely different. And then people who are talking about choice are talking about something completely different. It's a two different conversations. And that's why they just keep talking past each other. And my best friend is I would go so far as to say, I'm a very conservative Christian from Cincinnati. and he doesn't live there anymore. We're still very close, and he's very pro-life. And he's a person who just believes that's his life, that's a soul, that's a human being. And I don't believe that it is until viability. And I didn't know about the argument of viability until, you know, 26 weeks and all that, until it just occurs to you naturally as a human being, well, is this something that could live on its own or not? And when it can, then you go, oh, well, crossing that line seems pretty serious. But where do you draw that line? And a lot of my friends are pro-choice, and I've made a pro-life argument to them, and I am pro-choice myself, and I have been as long as I can remember. I have every single political viewpoint that I've had since I was 13 or 14 when we learned about it in seventh grade. I go, well, it's this. And I don't think I've really changed much, and maybe that shows no growth, but I think it just shows like I'm a moderate, and I see both sides very clearly. And I would just say that to all my pro-choice friends, exactly what you just said. We have to understand that some people, yeah, for some people, it's about subjugation of women. And, you know, it is that kind of a thing. But there are a lot of people out there who just believe that's a human being. And how do you argue that? How do I say you're wrong? I can't say that. I don't know how.
I agree. I admire your balanced view on it.
Yeah, it's we're a dying breed, James. We're a dying breed. There's not a lot of that. I'm feeling pretty hopeless about the future of the country. And I'm not only I grew up very patriotic, but also I'm a natural optimist. I mean, before Rudy Giuliani became who he became, he gave a talk that was, I think, telecast to P&G. And Rudy Giuliani, in his heyday, who was someone I greatly admired at the time, talked about how, hey, if you want to be a pessimist, but you can't be a leader. Leaders have to be optimists. And that really stayed with me when he said that. And I quoted him all the time up until his transformation, which to me is an embodiment of the way America has gone. You know, at the time, though, I thought of that. And do you agree with that? I mean, leaders have to be optimists, right? Or they at least have to have that nature and see a brighter future.
I agree. He you know, it's funny you talk about him. He came to Manila, and there was a leadership series. He was brought by the mayor of Manila at the time, who later became vice president, a guy named Binay. Hmm. And we were on the leadership panel together. And he made a statement that I always loved and I've always followed. He said, great leaders never miss a wedding of their people, and they never miss a funeral. Hmm. Because they're always with their people in the happiest moments of their life and their saddest moments of their life.
Wow.
And it really hit me hard. And I always made a point of like, when one of my people, if their father passes away, I go to the funerals.
Right.
I go all the funerals of a close family member of any of my people. And I certainly go to all their weddings. If they invite me, I mean, if they don't invite me, I don't, yeah. I'm you not just crashing. Show up. You know, but if it, you know, it's assuming like I'm invited, mm-hmm. You know, I go, and I think it's good. And, you know, Rudy suffers from what a lot of people suffer. I mean, you know, the long list, the Kardashians, I mean, all kinds of people, they have to be relevant, and it drives them crazy when they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shame that he has swallowed every principle that he ever espoused. And, you know, to hear the former people that worked with him in the Southern District of New York and say, this is not even the same human being.
Yeah.
You know, it's sad. And you know, he'll do anything to stay relevant because, you know, his political career after that run for the White House, you know, he was out by Florida. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was really out of the game. And I think he thought he could win it given his response to 9/11 and how he handled those days. And he was good on those days.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, it's sad. It's sad. It relevancy becomes so important that you'll do anything. And you see that in certainly in political leaders mm-hmm. that who will say and do anything to stay in office.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Somebody asked me here the other day and they said, what political leaders do you admire? Do you admire anyone in the U.S. in politics? I said, absolutely yes. Mm. And then they said, yeah, but like who? I said, you know, honestly, and I didn't like her father one bit, but Liz Cheney.
Yeah.
I would high five her.
Absolutely.
Because you know what? I may not agree with her position on things, but she's a woman of principle and backbone. And she sticks to her story.
Dude.
But you know, people that, you know, on January 6th, who they trashed Trump, thinking he was dead, but then when he came back to life and he still had his base, they suddenly fly to Mar-a-Lago to kiss the ring. And that, how can you respect this?
I don't know
damn well when Trump and the Trumpism will go. I mean, we're in a period now of what it's basically McCarthyism too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's McCarthyism too. And and history will be very, very, very brutal on this generation.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're thinking long term, Liz Cheney will come out of this good.
I agree. I said that to my wife.
Mm-hmm. She'll come out of this just fine.
I agree. I said to her, to my wife, I said, I probably disagree with almost all of her political positions, but I would absolutely vote. I would very seriously, strongly consider voting for her for president. And my wife was a little taken aback by that, you know, because I'm left of center and I'm not crazy liberal or anything. Not that I'm impugning people who are. But I was like, exactly what you just said. I'm like, this takes so much courage. And that's the basis of leadership is courage. It's just doing those little things and the big things, you know, just in the face of such adversity. I cannot even imagine the death threats that she's getting, especially as a woman. And it's admirable beyond anything. And I'm totally on the same page with you. I wish we could keep talking. This has been a phenomenal conversation. I knew it would be great. I didn't know it'd be this great, but could I ask you if you have anything else to say? We've asked you before about your advice to the next generation of leaders, but I kind of threw the questions out the window when we started talking about all the other stuff. And I thought, you know what, let's just have a conversation as two human beings. But I wanted to give you the mic one more time to say anything you might want to say.
No, I think, you did a great job as always. And it's always fun talking with you and, you know, bantering a bit back and forth. The only thing I would say is about it being a P&G alum for a minute. I mean, the people are listening to this, the majority are P&G alums. So there's an old saying, which is you never recognize the greatest moments in your life until they're in your rear view mirror. You don't really know when you're living the moment, you don't realize that this is a great moment. It's only upon retrospection that you can understand that was a great moment. And I'll always believe my best years are in front of me. That time in P&G was just incredibly uniquely special. And the people that I worked with and the John Peppers and the Tom Hanleys and the Daryl Mobleys and Mark Weavers, all these bosses that just put this time into me. They took this kid from University of Cincinnati with a psych degree and, his hair parted down the middle, and turned him into something. I mean, that's why even if P&G pushed me out in the end, I would never be angry and never be bitter because I owe more to P&G I could never repay. And I think all of us have to really recognize that we were part of a very special place. And it's always going to be with us and it's always something we can support. And it's always something that you can look back with great fondness and reflection of what you learned. And so that's why I'm always going to be there for the P&G alumni and for the company. You know, when they ask me to come back and speak, I'm always there. It's a tremendous place and a tremendous culture. And you know what? It's just as strong now as it's ever been. It's this whole thing of the company is not the same. Yes, of course it's not the same, but it hasn't lost its soul and it hasn't lost its culture and it hasn't lost its commitment to excellence. It's still an amazing company that, we should all be proud that we were a part of it.
Thank you so much, James Michael Lafferty. Appreciate the kind words as well as all of your time and joining us on the P&G Alumni Podcast. This has just been a tremendous experience for me and really, really appreciate your time and your energy and your enthusiasm. So best of luck to you and thanks for joining us again on the P&G Alumni Podcast. I've been your host, Rajiv, and I still am.
Thank you for having me and thanks for thinking of me.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Please subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast or email pgalumpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment in communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
That's it for this week. I've been Rajiv Sathyal.
And I'm still Raman Segal. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.